Cable at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month's screening is Black February on Thursday, February 13th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Black February chronicles a remarkable series of concerts spanning from funk to symphonic works, providing unique insight into New York's vibrant avant-garde music scene. Again, that's Black February on Thursday, February 13th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU's news and public affairs programs are fueled by our volunteers, and we are always looking for more people to get involved. On Tuesday, February 11th, from 5 to 6 p.m., we will be holding a news and public affairs orientation. This training will offer a crash course in news production and public affairs. In just an hour, we will cover our philosophy, our expectations, how it all comes together, and how you can get started with us. Again, that's the News and Public Affairs Orientation on Tuesday, February 11th from 5 to 6 p.m. at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Sign up on VicNet or email newsdirector@kabu.org to get registered. See you there.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is Carmen Maria Machado. Machado's debut short story collection, Her Body and Other Parties, was the winner of the Bard Fiction Prize, the Lambda Literary Award for Lesbian Fiction, the Brooklyn Public Library Literature Prize, the Shirley Jackson Award, and the National Book Critics Circle's John Leonard Prize, as well as being a finalist for the National Book Award, the World Fantasy Award, and the Kirkus Prize. In 2018, the New York Times listed Her Body and Other Parties as one of 15 remarkable books by women that are shaping the way we read and write fiction in the 21st century. Machado's essays, fiction, and criticism have appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, Granta, Tin House, Conjunctions, McSweeney's, Best American Science Fiction and Fantasy, Best American Non-Required Reading, and elsewhere. She holds an MFA from the Iowa Writers' Workshop and is the writer-in-residence at the University of Pennsylvania. Carmen Maria Machado returns to Between the Covers today to discuss her much-anticipated debut memoir out from Grey Wolf entitled In the Dream House. With starred reviews from Booklist, Bookpage, Kirkus, and Publishers Weekly, and already named a Best Book of the Year by The New Yorker, Time Magazine, The New York Times, NPR, Publishers Weekly, The Atlantic, The Paris Review, and many others, In the Dream House has done the seemingly impossible, not only meeting but exceeding the expectations of readers after her remarkable debut. Gabino Iglesias at NPR says, In the Dream House is the most innovative memoir I've ever read. This book is a scream that ensures visibility, a chronicle of truth that weighs more than 1,000 theories and all the efforts to erase the reality of abuse in lesbian couples. Throughout all of it, Machado learns to navigate her own sexuality and her writing while making sure she understands the place she occupies in a world that has always tried to erase women like her. This book makes that erasure impossible. Katie Wallman for The New Yorker adds, Machado's writing, with its heat and precise command of tone, has always had a sentient quality. But what makes In the Dream House a particularly self-aware structure, which is to say a true haunted house, is the intimation that it is critiquing itself in real time. Here and in her short stories, Machado subjects the contemporary world to the logic of dreaming. Finally, Parul Sehgal at The New York Times says, there is something anxious and very intriguing in the degree of experimentation in this memoir, in its elaborately titivated sentences, its thicket of citations. The flurry, the excess, feels deliberate and summons up the image of the writer holding a ring of keys, trying each of them in turn to unlock a resistant story, to open a door she might be hesitant to enter. In the Dream House is written into the silence surrounding violence in queer relationships, the silences around emotional and psychological abuse, a living archive of her own loving idiosyncratic design. Welcome back to Between the Covers,
thank
Carmen
you.
Maria Machado.
Thank you for having me. What a beautiful introduction. That was so nice.
So ever since the final moments when you were here a couple years ago, when you mentioned that your next book would be a memoir, and I think at that point it was called A House in Indiana.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A memoir that would be both experimental and about abuse and queer relationships. It's loomed very large in my imagination. And I've been in anticipation of this conversation ever since that time. It doesn't take long for the reader to realize when they open the book that the house where the story takes place in is itself a means to tell the story, and in a way is a character within the story. It reminds me a little bit of your essay that we discussed last time, Why Alice Munro Should Play Gone Home, mm-hmm. where you quote Munro's introduction to her selected stories, and she says that in that introduction, a story is not like a road to follow, it's more like a house. You can go back again and again, and the house, the story, always contains more than you saw the last time. So I was hoping maybe you could tell us the story of finding the form, how early or late in the process you found it, and if there are ghost versions of In the Dream House that exist in either a different form or a different mode or a different shape.
Yeah. So it's so funny with this book because I feel like people keep asking me, you know, how did you write this book? And I'm like, unlike my first book, I wrote it in such weird bursts and fits, and like, there's not like a neat, like in the, or rather, Her Body and Other Parties had a very neat sort of like, there was the time I wrote the first story and a time I wrote the last story. And I consider those times in between, like the length of time it took to write the book. But this one went through so many phases and so many drafts, and I sold a really weird draft to Grey Wolf that is now like really different. And the final book is really different. So yeah, so for, I mean, a while, like basically as soon as sort of the events of In the Dream House were over, I was trying to sort of commit something to the page, and it was all pretty terrible. Like, I wrote some really bad essays. I wrote, like, just stuff. Like, I just sort of tried to commit things to the page. And I was really struggling, I think, because I was trying to tell it in a straightforward way. Like, I was just sort of describing what happened, and it wasn't very interesting, and it wasn't very beautiful, and it wasn't much of anything. And I felt very frustrated. And whatever I would sort of put down, just it wasn't really working for me. And then in like 2015, I at that point I had moved to Philadelphia with my now spouse, but I went back to Iowa City to teach at this, there's this like summer, I call it like summer nerd writing camp for high schoolers. It's this really delightful program, and I would have like killed to have done it when I was a teenager. But so I was in Iowa City like teaching these teens and doing this workshop, and you know, every day we were talking, I was talking a lot about craft, and like I was talking a lot about genre because that's like the thing that sort of interests me more than anything else in writing. And so I was talking a lot about genre, and then I would have all this free time, and I would just be like wandering around Iowa City. And at some point I began to think about haunted houses and the gothic and the way in which those genres have sort of spoken to me and the way they're so interesting to me. And when I talk about them, I could feel myself getting very sort of animated and, you know, thinking about space. Like, what does it mean for a space to be haunted? Like, what does that mean precisely? Like, outside of the traditional sort of, oh, someone died there, or, you know, something terrible happened there, you know. Yeah, and then at some point there was just a series of thoughts, like idle thoughts, and then at some point I was like, I wonder if the way to write this book is actually sort of fragmented and is using genre as like a mode, but like many genres, not just one genre, as like modes of interrogation. And then I just did it, and I, by the time I had left Iowa City, I had made like a whole list of different genres I wanted to play with, and then I began, I mean, but I still was picking away at it, you know. So the first draft that I wrote was very, it was like entirely in second person, totally by accident. It was entirely like memoir bits. Like, it wasn't any of the sort of analysis or essay or pop culture or any of that stuff. It was just, this happened. But having the genres as a way of writing, actually, I found it really fruitful. And like, I've been describing it as like, then the whole draft, like a draft like fell out of me like a wet baby giraffe, you know. It was like all legs and slime and had a really far way to go, but it did it. And then it was like, and it had all the makings of the big giraffe in it, but it was still little, you know. And so Yeah, and then I was picking away at it, and I would sort of have these bursts of productivity. So, like, I had a big burst of productivity fall 2016, which was when I was at Yotto finishing up Her Body and Other Parties, or I was finishing the edit. So I was exchanging emails with my editor. I would send him a draft. He'd send me back some notes, and we were going back and forth like that for, like, a few months. And so in between those emails and me working on the collection, I just kept working on the memoir. And then in early 2017... I feel so weird explaining this. It's like such insider baseball, but, like, basically I had showed it to my agent and I had said, you know, I know it's really rough, but, like, do you think this is worth showing to anybody? And he was like, I do. I actually feel like, you know, even though it is rough, like, the project is very clear, you know? And so Grey Wolf also was inquiring if I had any other books because, you know, I think at that time, it was before the collection came out, but I think they had a sneaking suspicion that it was going to blow up really big, and they wanted to sort of pick another book up for me if possible while they could afford me. And so they asked after it, and I said, I do have this, like, really weird project, and I feel weird because I feel like it's really raw and it's very, like, unformed still, but I feel like Grey Wolf would also be a really good home for it. And because I feel like they more than anyone would be able to, like, do right by a book like that, that is just so niche and so experimental and so sort of strangely structured. And
well, I want to linger on the question of form and of architecture for a minute before.
Oh, sure. Before sure. Go, yeah. Sorry.
Before we move on to the quote unquote story of the book.
Right.
Because
because
the book announces its form and makes the scaffolding or the act of its own making visible. The building of the building is sort of what we navigate at the beginning of the book. And I'm thinking kind of like in the New York Times review when they're saying that sense of fumbling for which key is going
to... I love that quote. I read that quote out loud to several people. I was like, I really like that quote. It feels really accurate.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you about the beginning because as far as the scaffolding goes, we get three epigraphs. And each epigraph is a standalone epigraph on its own page. So we flip the page three times. We see three different epigraphs. And then there's an overture where you confess that you never read prologues, that you both distrust them and find them tedious. And then we get a really remarkable prologue. And then finally, after this great prologue, we get another standalone epigraph before we move into the book. So tell us about this series of moves, this sequence of what I would call doors in the New York Times lingo. What is the effect you're going for, or what are you trying to evoke by this layering that we, or this navigation that we have to go to before we start?
God, it's so funny hearing you describe it out loud. I'm just like, my first reaction is like, God, I'm such an like, what is that nonsense? No, I mean, there's, okay, like, how to explain that process. So I'm, like, trying to think of, like, the correct order, like, in which those things happen. So I was sort of constantly working with I actually had more epigraphs, if you could believe it. I had a whole bunch, and I was like, I feel like three is the most I could get away with before someone's, like, making fun of me. So I spent a lot of time trying to decide, and, you know, I ended up, I mean, I wanted that Zora Neale Hurston quote because it felt really true and really important to me. The Louise, I don't know how to say her last name. I don't speak French.
Oh, Bourgeois?
Yeah. That quote about, like, memory and architecture, it, you know, felt very, like, appropriate for the project. And I was actually, there was a very early phase, like, after I sold the book to Grey Wolf, but when I was still kind of putting it together, where I thought about using some of her work as, like, a structural element. And I ended up sort of completely sort of avoiding that. But that quote kind of remained from that process. So that was, like, it was hanging up, like, in one of my little houses when I was working on it. And then there's that quote from Angel Street by Patrick Hamilton. So that's the play that Gaslight, the film Gaslight, was based on, the two films of Gaslight. Your mind is indeed tired. Your mind so tired that it can no longer work at all. You do not think, you dream. Dream all day long, dream everything, dream maliciously and incessantly. Don't you know that by now? And that's a line being delivered by the husband to the wife in that play. And that actually came a little later because the title in the dream house didn't exist yet. And it was really weird because once I had decided on that title, the sort of many levels of that title began working and actually ended up becoming very, like, important, even though that process happened, like, fairly late in the game. And I was like, that epigraph feels really necessary. Like, I was rereading Angel Street and I, like, happened upon that quote and I, like, you know, underlined it 10,000 times and, like, circled it. It was like, oh my God, you know, and I have to put that in there. So the epigraphs felt necessary, and I feel like, you know, part of trying to establish oneself, like, I feel like part of this project is about context and about creating context around yourself and, like, where do you belong in the history of things, and where do you belong in the literature of things, and where do your experiences go? And I feel like that was a really important part of the process. And so, like, part of that is, like, a sort of a setting up, like, these sort of lodestones right in mm-hmm. the very beginning, where you're like, here are three really different artists writing from, like, really different traditions and, like, really different, you know, they're working from totally different spaces, who have these three quotes that, like, are really speaking to the project. And then initially, I actually didn't have the overture. I just had the prologue. And the prologue also came really late. Like, basically, once I started researching stuff about archival silence and put that chapter together, that first chapter, I was really proud, because I feel like a thing I struggled with this book was turning the more research-heavy sections into readable prose, which is, like, a thing I never really had to do before and is actually quite difficult. So when I would, like, read stuff out loud to myself, like, I'd be reading a piece that I'd written about my own experience, and it would, like, read really well, and then I would hit, like, a research piece, and, like, I felt like the prose would just die on the page. Mm. Like, it was so flat, because I was, like, and so I feel like learning how to massage research into, like, beautiful sentences is, like, very hard. And so that was, like, a big part of the process. So I was really proud when I wrote that chapter, because I felt like it was really good, and I felt like it was really working on a lot of levels. It was a really good introduction to the thing, and I thought prologue would be a really good, even though it's funny because I kept thinking, like, I always hate prologues, but, like, I guess this is a prologue. I don't know what else to call it, because it's like an introduction, you know, it's sort of like an almost an overview, or like an introduction to, like, what the reader's about to read. And then and then my editor pointed out to me that it might be sort of strange to open up a memoir with not my own words. He's like, you have three epigraphs, and then you start off with a quote by Sadia Hartman. Don't you think that's a little strange? And I was like, oh, that's a really good point. And so then I was like, well, I should open with something else. But what comes before a prologue? Nothing. And then I was like, oh, wait, an overture. So yeah, so then I was like, I might as well just, like, insert my own skepticism about prologues into the thing. So it was like a very, like, and then I was like, oh, and then I'm like, I want it to be in five sections, and each of the sections is gonna have their own epigraph. I'm just like a weird, I'm amazed that they let me get away with, honestly. I feel like it's like I'm the person who's, like, in the grocery store, like, back when my spouse and I were on a really, really tight budget, like, I was the one at the store being like, I want that, can we get that please? And she'd be like, no, we can't afford it. And I feel like I'm like that, but as a writer, like, I'm like, can I just have eight epigraphs? Like, yeah. Why can't I have eight epigraphs? Like, whatever.
Well, and somehow it's all worked. And I wanted to ask you about that, because in your description of the video game Gone Home, you call it a symphonic structure where each tiny story in their own right sort of suggests an Oulipo-like constraint.
Yeah.
And this symphonic yet constraint-based structure seems like one way you could describe In the Dream House 2, where each chapter starts with the phrase Dream House as. So we have Dream House as world building, Dream House as fantasy, Dream House as public relations, and so on. And near the beginning, much like where you give this distrust of the prologue and then the prologue, you give us the chapter Dream House as not a metaphor, but then nearly 150 different Dream House chapters that feel like attempts at comparing it to something else, or for it to be representative of something else, or for you to try to tell your story through a different trope or a different slant, kind of like Kanoe's exercises and styles. So when I think of Kevin Brockmeyer's blurb for the book, which calls it a book that builds itself entirely out of left turns, but can seem by its final pages to have followed the surest possible path to its center, I guess. And also there's this other review that talked about each chapter having great ambition and failing, and then somehow also acknowledging that all of the failures come together as a success. I wanted to hear about this notion, or this reader response of left turns that get you to the heart of the matter, mm-hmm. and how does that strike you? Is that something that you, is that the sort of labyrinth that you feel like you created, or is that something you're learning about the work and hearing other people describe it that way?
I feel like that description, those descriptions you just mentioned, also that thing from Perul's review of the keys, sort of fumbling with the keys, right, is about as accurate as you can possibly get when it comes to thinking about these sections. And I mean, obviously, like, bits where I sort of undermine the reader, or I sort of, like, yeah, like, tell you it's not a metaphor and then like give you a lot of metaphors and tell you I hate prologues and give you a prologue. Like, that's just me being a rascal. But I also I also feel like there's something really, because, you know, genre is all about expectation, and it's all about like, what can you expect from a piece of work about the world that you're in? And, you know, that expectation can be very, you know, when it's, I think, best executed is when there's a level of subversion to it, where like sort of the you know, or it's like really done really, it's either done really completely and it was a really like exquisite exercise in its own genre, or it's like undermining its own genre in some meaningful way. And I feel like that's always when I really respond to a piece of work. And so I feel like, yeah, the process of sort of saying, you know, you can imagine all these different things, but like the fact of the matter is, when I tried to tell the story in a straightforward way, I couldn't, and no one would listen to me. And so I'm just gonna like throw every metaphor at the wall and just like, you know, walk you through like the ways in which I sort of can insufficiently conceive of like what happened, where I belong, what context I should be entered into, what is the real fact or truth of my experience. So I feel like that is a very, like, probably the most sort of astute kind of read on the tone of the book. And I feel like also in Katie Walden's review, she had some really great line about, which I felt like actually really captured me to a T, which is like something about how it's so kind of all over the place that if I didn't have a tremendous amount of control, the whole thing would like fall apart. And I think that is like sort of me in a nutshell, honestly. Like, I feel like, you know, I'm really interested in ambitious work and work that really like pushes its own boundaries and like pulls itself right, you know. And I feel like I just read this quote, I think it was Garth Greenwald, it might have been in Lit Hub, because, you know, he's interviewing right now for his new book, and which is stunning. And
you did a great interview of him.
Oh yeah. Oh, did you? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He did an event the video of you.
Philly. It was he's just a brilliant speaker. I feel like it isn't that hard to do a good interview with him. You just ask him a non-terrible question and then he just gives you some like stunning, breathtaking answer. He's so good. But he said something about like, you know, writing to sort of their one's own edge, like writing sort of to the limits of one's own capacity. And I feel like so much of this book was really scary for me, because I did feel like I was writing to the edge of my capacity in terms of like writing from research and like writing about the past, trying to explain things that were kind of unexplainable, you know, trying to like be sympathetic and like explain to people like even though you might feel ways about me or about like what I have to say, that like I need to explain to you what it felt like. And, you know, and so I feel like there was so much of it that was about that. And that the experimentation became sort of part of that process of like writing to the edge and trying to like, and I think that to me is like the most exciting work, you know, in general. And I feel like, yeah, I don't know. And so I feel like that was sort of part of the process, and that sort of like, and I feel like, you know, in terms of like the sort of, like, I feel like the closest example to this book that I have already written is the Law and Order story from especially Heinous, from Her Body and Other Parties, because I feel like it also has that symphonic structure and is like a way of thinking about like how to tell a single story through many, many stories, you know, and sort of in that, and also has like a kind of a similar structure.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Carmen Maria Machado about her book In the Dream House from Grey Wolf. So In the Dream House ends with an engagement with endings, which seems great since it begins with an engagement with prologues. How to end a story that never really ends, that continues to reverberate through and informs one's life. So maybe for the ending of our conversation, we can talk about what's coming up for you. I know that you have a limited series with DC Comics, The Low, Low Woods.
Yes.
So maybe you could talk about that, and also what we can expect next from you otherwise, so that we can wait with a bated breath for...
Well, I can say that I'm working on a new fiction project, which I'm very excited about, and I've been really enjoying getting back into fiction. I really missed it. And then, yeah, I have this series from DC, which is now, the third issue is coming out in mid-February. So issues 1 and 2 are already out. It's Joe Hill is curating this line of comics called Hill House, and it's a really, it's been really fun, actually. I've been really enjoying it. You know, I was writing scripts for it, which is like a very new thing for me, so that was like kind of interesting, but I think I really took to it. Like, the editors at DC were very impressed, like, because I think, you know, it's hard for a prose writer to like move to like a different medium. Not necessarily, but it would, I sort of thought it would be harder. I took a screenwriting class in college. I did very badly in it. So like, I feel like I was like, I don't know if I can do this, but it's sort of a weird mix because it's because there, you can do a lot of narration and I am directing the art. So like, you know, I would say like in this panel, like this character looks at this character and like in the background you see blah, blah, blah. Like it's very specific, you know, and it's almost, and also there's like a lot of opportunities for narration, which also kind of, I can indulge my prosy voice, you know, in the narration. So yeah, it's really great. And I've really been enjoying like the collaborative element of it, and the art is beautiful and they've done a really good job. And it's like also like a really fun, it's like really nice to write a story with like two characters that are like, it's weird because it's like they're not, there's no I voice. I mean, there is because there are like, they both alternate narrating the but like I feel like I write, my first book, almost every story was from an I voice, and this is one of the first times that I've ever written a story where there's like two characters, like in this case Octavia and Elle, and like they are these third person characters that I get to write about, and it's like really, really fun. Yeah, that process has been really great and I've really been enjoying it, and it's been very like fruitful for me. And
is your new fiction a collection or is it a novel?
It's like a linked, it's sort of hard to explain, it's like a linked collection. It's like I've been very admiring of how Garth Greenwell's new book is being marketed as a book of fiction,
yeah,
and not, which I at first found very confusing, but now I find very liberating. So I'm like, it's a book of fiction. I mean, he described it in all his interviews as like a song cycle, but like,
yeah,
it's yeah, so it's stories that are set in the same universe through various periods of time, in which like and there's a comet that's like tearing through space time, that is going to tear through all these realities all at once. So in each story, the comet has appeared for the first time in history, but like in each, even though the stories move through history, like right. move. So yeah. So but they're individual stories. Like they're sort of about different time periods, different kinds of characters, but sort of, I'm sort of gnawing on stuff about like sex and like out off brand for me, sex and also like memory and like consciousness, and I read a lot about like, I don't know, I'm really interested, I've been reading a lot about like comet panics, like astrological panics of the history, which have been very interesting. Yeah, I don't know, it's been really fun. It's like, it's a lot of historical fiction, which is new for me as well. So yeah, I've really been enjoying that, and it's really nice. I kept, you know, the writing this book was really, really hard, the memoir, and I'm really grateful to
be on the other side.
Yeah, I'm grateful to be like back in fiction and being able to like write about pain, but not my pain.
Yeah. Could we end with Dreamhouse's ending?
Sure, of course.
Is that too much of a spoiler to do that?
I mean, no,
you talk about it in interviews.
I think so.
It's up to you.
Dreamhouse as ending. That there's a real ending to anything is, I'm pretty sure, the lie of all autobiographical writing. You have to choose to stop somewhere. You have to let the reader go. Where to stop this story? Vows in my wedding on a hot day in June. Some narratively satisfying confrontation between the woman from the dream house and me. If you grasp the story by the base and pull, will the ripping sound indicate the looseness of the roots? What is left behind in the soil? Should I loop back to a memory from the dream house, a lovely one? Will that work, a contrast between what could have been and what was? A memory of the two of us freshly returned from a local winery, sipping on a spicy Zinfandel and eating some kind of feta dip and telling a story. One day, the woman from the dream house will die, and I will die, and Val will die, and John and Laura will die, and my brother will die, and my parents will die, and her parents will die, and everyone who ever knew any of us will die. Is that the end of the story? Time's mindless, chattering advancement? There is a Panamanian folktale that ends with, my tale goes only to here. It ends, and the wind carries it off. It's the only true kind of ending. Sometimes you have to tell a story, and somewhere you have to stop. Is the spoiler that we're all going to die? Because I have a spoiler for all y'all listening, and also you. Death will come for all of us.
It was so great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
We're talking today to Carmen Maria Machado about her new memoir, In the Dream House, from Grey Wolf. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
Cable at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month's screening is Black February on Thursday, February 13th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Black February chronicles a remarkable series of concerts spanning from funk to symphonic works, providing unique insight into New York's vibrant avant-garde music scene. Again, that's Black February on Thursday, February 13th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Black Book Talk with hosts Emma Jackson Ford, Obi Hill, and Patricia Welch. Let me tell you about this girl. Maybe I should. I met her in Philly, and her name was Brian. See, we be making love constantly. That's why my eyes are a shade. Blood burgundy. The way that we kiss is unlike any other way that I be kissing. When I'm kissing, what I miss, won't you listen? Brown sugar, babe, I guess high up your love, I don't know how to behave. Brown sugar, sugar, I know.
Good morning and welcome to the February edition of Black Book Talk. I am Patricia Welch, Librarian Emeritus.
Obi Hill, let's read, walk, and talk.
And Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman.
And this morning, we are delighted to welcome back to Portland via the airwaves, Charlotte Watson Sherman. We're going to talk to her about her latest book, Brown Sugar Babe, which is just such a beautiful book. I mean, I just encourage all of you to try to find the book just to glory in the artwork. It is an absolutely beautifully illustrated book and a lovely poem. And Charlotte, some of you may know, may remember, was at one time the computer lab coordinator at the North Portland Library. So she is familiar to Portland, and some of you may be familiar with her and another guys. But author Charlotte, welcome to Black Book Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for this book. This book was just so lovely to look at. Tell us a little bit about the book so, you know, people will know. Later on, we'll ask you to